before I start, one thing. I have a couple video clips today, and there's some stuff that's kind of violent. So if there's small children in the room anywhere, I don't see a ton, but just warning you, violence. As a friend of mine told me once, when he was trying to convince his parents to let him play violent video games, everyone who dies is bad. So today, everybody who dies, all the violence is for bad people, so we're good, okay? I have interesting hobbies. So, and sometimes my hobbies kind of get me into a bit of trouble. So today I want to tell you about one of the times that I got buried in an avalanche in the middle of nowhere. So, yeah, under snow, avalanche on top of me, hoping I don't die. And it kind of started off in a beautiful day. Me and my climbing partner, Jeff, we drove out to the Ghost together, and it was like pretty, you know, blue skies, gorgeous day. Sun was shining. It's one of those days that's why you go to the mountains. You know, it's just like so beautiful. The mountains are so beautiful. The sky is so beautiful. Everything's so beautiful. So we're hiking up this thing and the wind starts to pick up a little bit. So we start zipping up our jackets because the snow is blowing like down our jackets. We're a little chilled, so zip up our jackets. And it's the kind of climb where you hike a little bit, then you climb a bit of ice, and the ice is nice and blue and beautiful. And the ice climbing was really good. Then you hike a little bit, then you climb, hike, climb, hike, climb. We get to this final pitch. It's about probably 30 feet high, maybe a little higher than the roof of this thing. And it's a scary one. I've never climbed it. I've never led it myself, which means I go up on top of the rope. And if I fall a long ways. I've never done that before. Last time someone went up first and I followed him up, so it's much safer. But I was what's called the rope gun, which means that I have to do all the hard stuff that day. So I kind of sit at the bottom and pace, and there's this whole thing you do, you kind of do one of these like this is like you're not warming up, you're like trying to get the nerves down, because if you freak out, things are going to go really bad. That's when you fall. So I kind of keep looking up and I'm like checking my line. Finally I'm like okay, I got this, and I checked my knot like 14 times, not because the first time it wasn't right, but because I'm freaked out, and this is what you do to calm yourself. So finally I get my tools in my hands and I'm like, so I start climbing, and it's somehow, like, all the gods of ice climbing came together in that moment, and I climbed it. Like, I got to the top, and I was like, how did I even get here? It was beautiful. And I was, like, doing a little dance. I bring my partner up. I'm like, suddenly I'm, like, invincible, right? I just climbed that climb. Like, what else can go wrong? So there's this last gully, or maybe let's think of it as, like, a half funnel. It's like this, and the ridge is right along the top. So we start hiking up this thing. So it's about 45 degrees, and the snow is really stiff, so you're kick-stepping in, putting your axes in, kind of like you see on TV. And a little ways up, my climbing partner's like, well, at this point, the wind's pretty bad. So we've fully zipped up, hoods up, start yelling at each other, and he screams at me. He's like, Vince, you think the slope's okay? What he's asking is, do you think it's going to avalanche? So I stick my hand in the snow and, like, yank on it, and I'm like, oh, bomb-proof. I'm like, no worries. He's like, okay. We keep climbing. About another half hour later, we're about three quarters of the way up, and he stops me again. He's like, again, he's got to like come close to me and yell at me. He's like, Vince, I'm not feeling this. And the way we climb is, if one person's not feeling it, we all go down. Whether everyone else is feeling good or not, if one person's feeling bad, we go down. So I was kind of like, okay, yeah, whatever. And so we turn around. And actually, this picture that she's going to put up here in a second, this is the picture I took just as we turned around at this point. Those crampons right there that you see, the boots right there, that's me. That's my climbing partner at the end of the rope. And so we're climbing down. I'm belaying him down so that he doesn't fall. Still feeling good. As you can see, it's looking a little blustery. You know, that's snow, and we're all zipped up. And we get to the top of, again, this ice fall that we just come down, and we're like, hey, nothing bad happened, right? Feeling good. Again, we're standing at the top of that ice fall, so it's about as high as this. We're standing at the top, haven't roped into anything. We're just kind of hanging out. So I say magnanimously, hey, why don't you rappel down first and I'll come after you. So we set up the rope and he starts to back over the edge of the thing. And I'm hanging out, you know, no big deal. Kind of doing one of the, like, kind of cold, so you're kind of moving around, just trying to stay warm. This time I'm staying warm, not freaked out. And all of a sudden I hear an airplane and I'm like, what in the world is an airplane doing out in the middle of the Ghost Valley? So I'm looking around and then look back up the slope we just came down and I suddenly see this plume of snow. And in about a millisecond, I realized that's not an airplane. That's an avalanche. And I'm standing at the bottom of that avalanche chute, not tied into anything, on top of a 30-foot cliff. this isn't good. So I did what anyone would do in that place. I ran like crazy, and I dove. There was an anchor, so there's a rope frozen into the ice. I dove for the anchor. I hooked my arm in it. It was kind of behind a rock, and I just did like full-on tuck and cover and got smoked by an avalanche. And I remember the first second or two, I was like, I'm dead. Like this is going to be the end. So you have moments of like, why the heck am I up here? Why didn't we turn around earlier? You know, those things aren't even going through my head. I'm just like, I'm dead. And after the first 2 seconds, I suddenly realized I'd felt the snow hit me and it yanked me, but it hadn't torn my arm out of the anchor yet. So I was like, I have this kind of brief moment of like, could this actually be okay? And then snow starts packing inside my mouth. And it starts to jam inside my mouth. I can feel it going, like pushing into my mouth. And I know from avalanche stuff that if it does that, as soon as you breathe on it, it turns to ice. And it basically suffocates you. So I went from, oh crap, I'm going to get hit by an avalanche, I'm freaking out, to there's a brief glimpse that I might get out of this alive, to I'm dead again. So before the snow stops in an avalanche, it's still kind of soft. So I quickly ducked my head in, shoved my free hand in front of my mouth so I could create a little air pocket so I could breathe. And I'm like, I think I'm okay again. And then suddenly I can feel this weight getting heavier and heavier and heavier on top of me. As the avalanche keeps going, it's depositing more and more snow on top of me. And I'm stuck on the bottom in fetal position, trying to cover so I have some breathing room, wondering, like, I'm 3 hours of 4x4ing, 2 hours of hiking to the top of a mountain. My climbing partner is probably dead because he got hit by the avalanche too. So if I don't get myself out of this, there's no one getting me out until spring, like when this all melts and they see my body come out. And so I don't know if this was rational, but I kind of shoved my head up, thinking that the snow would kind of push my body up, thinking that maybe I could at least get close enough to the top. I could, I don't know what. I didn't really have a plan. It was just like, I'm dying. This is bad. I need to do something. My brother's an amazing storyteller, and he taught me tons and tons about storytelling. And when he was teaching me about storytelling, he told me something that was fascinating. He said, Vince, your story is not about being caught in an avalanche. It's not. How many of you have been caught in an avalanche before? And yet, can you feel some of the pain, some of the fear? You can feel it because it's not a story about an avalanche. It's a story about fear, isn't it? Fear of being killed, fear of being buried, fear of being hurt, fear of being on the top of a mountain. It's amazing how stories are often, you think they're about one thing on the top, but when you really dig down into them, they're actually about something broader. And that's what I want to talk about today. I want to tell you two stories that I don't think are about what they seem like on the top, because I think the bottom piece is the important piece. You know the story, Lord of the Rings, Tolkien? I think that's a story exactly like my avalanche story. Has everyone seen it? Anyone know it? Everyone got it? Frodo, magic ring, gets away from the bad guy Sauron, you know, Mount Doom, blah, blah, blah. Bunch of people come along, help him out. It's all good. So the thing is that's interesting about this one is this. Let me say it this way. In the story, there's a wizard who kind of starts off this whole thing. His name is Gandalf. He's a wizard. He can do amazing, amazing things. So why didn't Gandalf just take care of the problem once and for all? And if you don't think he could, allow me Exhibit A, and let's just take a look at this clip, and I'll show you what Gandalf can do. Okay. He can beat a Belrock. You see that thing? Like when he does the whole lighting on fire? Like, if Gandalf can beat that guy, can't he just take a ring, call a magic bird, fly to, you know, Mount Doom, drop it in the thing, be back in time for lunch? Really? Lord of the Rings would have been like a chapter long. Enter Gandalf, ring, dead, done. The movies would have taken about 20 minutes. Life would have been good. So why? Why does Tolkien take like 3,000 pages? There's a little girl in the back actually reading it right now as we speak. 3,000 pages. The book's like this thick, right? Can you hold it up? Look how thick that book is. That's only the first book. Tolkien takes three of those to get to the end to kill this ring, right? Why does he take so much time? Peter Jackson makes into like, what, 60 hours of movies or something like that? So why didn't they just make Gandalf do it? Could have been done in a few minutes back in time for lunch. So why? Today we're on our second week of a series called The Book... Sorry, let me say it this way. A series on the book called The Gospel According to Mark. And from now on, for simplicity's sake, I'm going to disregard all accuracy and just call it Mark. Which, if I'm going to be honest, pains me a little bit, because technically we don't know if Mark actually wrote it. It's just a name we gave it. And lack of accuracy always bothers me. But to make today a little bit easier, I'm going to just call it Mark. Mark's the shortest gospel. And it's most likely the earliest one ever written. And it's about the life and times of Jesus. Kind of. Because it seems to be written so early, it's actually considered one of the least tarnished or the least colored. It's years and years of theology. As the books get later and later, something like John, we get a lot of theology into them. So we think probably the community around the Bible started to let some of that stuff leak in. Since Mark is so early, it's kind of the rawest gospel. And it's a fascinating book. People, theologians make a joke. They say you can't get saved in Mark. Because it doesn't have any of our classic salvation theology that Orthodoxy has grown up with. But it's a fascinating book, and it's worth studying. But it's got some problems. And Jeff talked about some of the ones, about seeing some of the problems we saw over the last week, and I just want to share a couple of them with you. He talked about it being written early, but not at the same time as Jesus. There wasn't a guy like with a little book writing down, okay, what'd you say, Jesus? Can you repeat that? You know that business? Most likely it happened a generation or two afterwards. So these are stories that are passed on to stories. There's also a problem with manuscripts. If you guys don't know, your Bible actually doesn't come in one whole piece. There's not like some original version that's like kept in some Smithsonian library. We have chunks of Bible. Sometimes it's just like, if this was the page in Mark, we'd have a corner ripped off, and that would be Mark. Sometimes we have whole sections. Sometimes we even have whole books. But there's differences between the different manuscripts. And so when we translate our Bibles into English, we use all those manuscripts. And there's sometimes differences between the different texts. So in Mark, we have the biggest one in the Bible. There's actually two endings to Mark. There's a short ending, and if you like reading a bit more, you can read the long ending. So it's significantly different. It causes all kinds of problems for scholars. We talked about the supernatural scenes in Mark. Jesus does these things, or at least the text talks about Jesus doing these amazing miracles. But the problem is, when we focus on the miracles, we sometimes miss the story. And so Jeff proposed this. What if you looked at the Bible through the lens of you can do what Jesus can do? And then ask yourself, why this story? Why is he doing what he's doing? Who is he interacting with? When you see it not as this supernatural thing, when you see it as a story, it changes a lot of how you see it. And that takes us to today, where I want to ask, why did Tolkien spend 3,000 pages to do what had been done in like a chapter by Gandalf? And it brings us to the story of Mark as well. So today I want to take you into what I call, or not what I call, it's called a reader response hermeneutic. Basically means that we're going to look at how the original reader would have read parts of Mark. In order to do that, I need you guys to put yourself in kind of Greco-Roman shoes. So here's the deal. I want you to imagine you're a fish for a living. This is what you do. Most likely you learned fishing from your parents. Spent your early years on the seas learning, you know, weather and tides and, I don't know, whatever sea people learn. But you learned it all. You learned where the fish live. I learned when I went fishing with guys from here, foam is home. I'm sure there's lots more to know about fish than foam is home. You learned to throw a net from shore or from your boat, how to mend nets, do all sorts of stuff. You learned how to manage boats, purchase boats, rent equipment, buy equipment, hire helpers. And the honest answer is you kind of did pretty good. You've done really well. In fact, you inherited the business from your parents, but you've grown it way beyond what they had. You purchased bigger boats, more nets, hired more people, and that led to more money. When you walk down the streets, people look at you like, wow, they've arrived. when they want to talk about something, they want to talk, they want you in the conversation. They want to bring things to you and say, hey, I was thinking about this idea. What do you think of that? You're respected. And it's in that kind of feeling you find yourself sitting one day on the Sea of Galilee, right on the shores, mending your nets. It's been a busy day. You caught a lot of fish. Nets break, I hear. You need to fix them. And that's when you look up and you see somebody staring at you. And it's kind of weird because after the first couple seconds of like, what is this person doing here? You realize it's the new rabbi from town. And he's kind of looking right at you, like not just surveying the stinky fish scene. He's like eyeballing you. And people call him Jesus. You can't help but wonder, what in the world is a rabbi doing in this place? Because let's be clear, rabbis don't hang out at the edge of the lake where the fishing happens. They're more like hang out at the temple kind of people. And it's not that they're snobby. It's not like they wouldn't hang out. But it's just, that's not where they do their thing. There's times in your life where your life and the rabbi's life overlap, you know, festivals, holidays, things like that. So it's not that you've never seen them. It's just that they don't really hang out where you work. And that's when Jesus did something that made you question whether he was a rabbi at all. Because there's a way that rabbis work with the people around them. You see rabbis all the time. They're always talking about the law this, the law that. Sometimes they call the law the Torah, same word. They talk about how to interpret it, how they interpret it, how to simplify it, how to coalesce it to smaller and smaller chunks. From when you were a kid, you've seen this. There's always the rabbi and the students. But that's the thing. There's a rabbi, and then there's students. But the students, and this is important, the students always approach the rabbi. It never works the other way. It's the students who came to the rabbi and said, I want to learn the law that you talk about. I want to learn the way you see it. I want to learn how you think about it. I want to learn the details. And when you're gone, I'll teach your way of talking about the law to the next people. I'll learn what you know, and I'll pass that on. That's how it worked. And everyone knows this. It's not like this is uncommon. You'd have known it. It's just natural. So for a rabbi to approach someone, to look him in the eye, and then to ask what Jesus asked, for lack of a better word, it's ridiculous. It would never happen that way. Not because of who you are, middle management fisherman, that's not why, but because rabbis never ask their students directly. The students always ask the rabbi. And here's Jesus looking at you, maybe for lack of a better word, looking into you. And he says this to you, come with me. I'll make a new kind of fisherman out of you. I'll show you how to catch men and women instead of perch and bass. So tell me, why would Jesus, a rabbi of some standing, break all protocol, throw out all tradition, completely go against everything that is the way that rabbis do things in the world, and ask you to follow him? Why? There's ways of doing things, and Jesus is basically completely disregarding them. There's a way of propagating the law, and everyone knew it. And yet Jesus didn't do it. So why does Jesus go against everything that everyone knew in the area about how to teach the law? Why does he do that? So why did Jesus go against all tradition? Why did he go out and ask these guys to follow him? I think the answer might lie actually in that clip from The Lord of the Rings. It's the last clip of the movie. Not the very last one, but it's how the movie ends. And as I mentioned before, it could have gone way quicker. You know, Gandalf snags the ring, fly mountain to Magic Eagle, Mount Doom, drop the ring off, you know, back in time for lunch. It could have gone a lot easier. And if the story is about destroying the ring, that's how I think it should have ended. When the ring was destroyed, the movie should have been done. But it doesn't. Tolkien ends it this way, with the crowning of the king, with bringing together all the people who were part of this saga, part of this group, brings them all together to celebrate what they've done, what they've accomplished. It ends with men and women and elves and dwarves and little hobbits celebrating the end of that super baddie Sauron. Because I don't think the movie's about just destroying the ring. I think The Lord of the Rings is a story about people fighting against evil, not letting evil triumph. They all fought in their own way. Some with swords, some with magic. Frodo was that fight against the evil draw. But in the end, they all won. Not because I think they destroyed the ring, but because they fought against evil. And those 12 people inspired the entire world of man to rise up against Sauron and fight the tyranny of evil. That's what I think the story of The Lord of the Rings is about. And I say it because of how Tolkien ends his story, with the triumph of people over evil. I think it was about getting people into the fight. So let's go back to Jesus now, in the story in Mark. What if Jesus' purpose wasn't to teach the law like his fellow rabbis? What if it wasn't about getting his followers to know something, to logic something out? What if it wasn't about learning the law? What if there's something else he had in mind? What if that's why Jesus broke all social rules, all ways of disciples and rabbis and students to work together? What if he blew that all out of the water because he was looking for something else? Something that needed middle management followers just like us to be a part of it. And I wonder if it wasn't about a thing that Jesus wanted to teach, but it was to create a group of people who fought for what he was fighting for. For a different world. A world free of evil. A world focused creating on heaven on earth. Because if that's what Jesus was about, it seems to make total sense why he wasn't acting like a normal rabbi, doesn't it? Because their goals weren't the same as his. It wasn't about destroying the ring. It was about getting people involved in the fight. Jesus wasn't about teaching knowledge. He was showing a way of life. I think that's why Jesus did everything wrong. In order to teach 12 people, and through them the rest of the world, how to live right. Those people shared their stories, and there's people who heard those stories shared them, and it kept going like that. Then a guy we call Mark heard these stories and wrote some of them down. And for the next 2,000 years, followers of the way of Jesus, Christians, have followed these stories and were inspired to live in a different way. To join the fight against evil and injustice, hatred and bigotry, racism and equality. To join the fight to bring heaven to earth, just like the 12 characters of The Lord of the Rings did. Along the way, we sometimes forgot that Jesus was a different kind of rabbi. We got lost in the teachings of the law like everybody else. We got lost in knowledge, but then we read a book like Mark, where the story of Jesus through the eyes of Mark, and we see Jesus again in a new way. And we see his mission with new eyes. And we remember that Jesus called 12 people together to learn how to live differently. Not just knowledge, but a new way of being in this world. And that takes us to this moment right here. We're a group of managers, business owners, workers, parents, students, teachers, you name it. We're a group of people sitting here at our metaphoric nets, And the rabbi Jesus has just walked in through the stories of Mark and is asking us to follow him, to follow his way, to join the fight to bring heaven to earth. Not necessarily because he couldn't do it himself. If that was the purpose of the stories in Mark, that book would have been way shorter too. Because I think it's because we play an unbelievably important role in this. So Jesus walked into your life today through this story and has asked you to join this new way of living. This way that tries to bring heaven to earth every day. Will you join it? We become a group of people called the followers of the way of Jesus, championing this way of making this world a better place. It's like the story of the Lord of the Rings. I don't think it's about destroying the ring. So too, the story of Jesus, I don't think is about learning more knowledge. I think the story of Jesus is about learning a way of living that brings heaven to earth. That's why we encourage you to do something like 31 and 31. If you don't know what else to do, it's a great place to start. That's bringing heaven to earth. Heard a story this week of a lady who, out of nowhere, banded together a bunch of her neighbors, and they're going to have a massive cook-off. They didn't even know where they're going to send the food yet. They just went, I can cook, and I think I can make the world a bit better with food. So they sent us a message saying, do you know anyone who can use some food? Because we want to help. We want to make this world a better place. These are the things, I think, that bring heaven to earth. I think this is the way we live like Jesus. Because I don't believe the story of Mark is about learning some more knowledge. I think it's about learning a way of living. So let me leave you with this. Would you join it? Would you join this new way of living in the world? Would you change your world for the better? If you're not sure what that means, 31 and 31 is a great place to start. Carmen's going to talk a bit more about it in a second. Start deliberately by doing something every day to make the world around you a better place. So let me leave you with this. May we all join the story of Jesus and realize that his story is really our story. Have a great week.